Hello and welcome to Taskmaster Talks with Kevin Sullivan. I am your co-host, JP John Paz, and with me, as always, is the star of the show, former WCW and ECW World Tag Team Champion, former NWA Florida Heavyweight Champion, one of the greatest minds and bookers in professional wrestling history, the Games Master, the devil himself, the Taskmaster, Kevin Sullivan. Kevin, what are you up to today, sir?
Well, I guess we're all trying to be social distancing. You know, I live on an island, so I can't be any more social distancing than that. But, well, hopefully this will blow over and we'll get back to normal, John, right?
Yep. You were social distancing before it was cool.
Yeah, so how are you doing?
Hey, not too bad. Doing pretty good. In this crazy world we now live in, you know, you're just trying to get by and keep it going. It does seem like a lot of the days kind of mesh together and you forget, you know, it's the end of the week or towards the end of the week already. It's kind of a little scary in certain senses, certain ways.
Right. You know, like you said, it's every day's Groundhog Day and they do run together.
Today, I definitely want to talk something about how we've been talking the last couple of weeks building up to the NWO, which may be the greatest angle ever in the history of wrestling, maybe the most well-booked angle, maybe probably the angle that saved wrestling or brought wrestling back into it. The 80s were huge. The 90s, as it's going through, is kind of slowing down. Boom, 96 happens. And then you get the hottest period ever in the history of professional wrestling. So last week, we kind of talked about a bash at the beach, 96, Hulk Hogan's epic heel turn, which was the greatest heel turn in the history of the business. Just unbelievable. Hall, Nash, and him create the NWO, the New World Order. Now as we're moving along, after Bash the Beach, what is your thought process and your thoughts, and what's the psychology, kind of going into having these three guys taking over the company?
Well, the thing was, we hit upon this, I think, last week, you and I, off radio. The third guy was so important, and, you know, I don't want to rehash what we talked about last week. But, I mean, I had to have him do it, and he did it, and he did it right. And then they took off, and it was so strong. And the thing that I look back at, not being able to use Razor and Diesel was probably the best thing we ever did because it made them more real. Think about it. We didn't know what to do when they first came because we knew we couldn't use Razor and Diesel. And we're talking about different names and stuff. And if you watch the first tape when Scott comes, then when Scott and Kevin come, we don't even mention who they are or don't even bring up, hey, what are they doing here? It was, what are they doing? And I think it added to the reality that we didn't give it a fake names because that by that time, people knew Scott was Scott Hall and from AWA. With Kurt Hennig, he was tag team champions. He wasn't no name. And then everybody knew Kevin from the multiple times he had characters he had in WCW, whether it was Vinnie Vegas or Oz. Or us giving the real names, I think, was a big boost to us.
I totally agree. Definitely. It added realism to it. It made it different. And it's like, wow, that's, you know, that's the direction. And it seems like ever since then, I think that a lot more wrestling will either the real name or they're pretending that it's the guy's real name. They'll make a name, you know, like Daniel Bryan, or, you know, they'll try to make it sound like it's their real name. So I feel like that kind of set off a definite chain of events throughout wrestling. We're like, okay, it's actually cool or different, or, you know, it's unique, or we should use our real names instead of a gimmick name, right?
Right. Yeah. I don't understand why guys sometimes change their names, which is just a takeoff of their regular name.
So as the NWO is kind of rocking and rolling here, it's just three guys. You know what I mean? It's Hogan, Hall, Nash, but it's so impactful. So many people are watching, and the ratings just going up and up and up. There's so much intrigue. Do you think at this point there is a plan in motion to add more guys to the group? Or right now, are you like, okay, this is great where we're at. We don't need anybody else in the group just yet?
I never wanted anybody but six in that group, you know, X-Pac. I think if we look back and put everything under a microscope, Eddie Graham used to say to me, we're digging for gold. We've reached in with our pan. We got the dirt and we got the rocks in there. And we're sifting it out. And we're going to try to save the gold, not lose the gold, but get rid of the dirt and the rocks. Well, my thing was, why? And again, I always say, if it's not broken, why fix it? I was always afraid of that. And I thought it would be their downfall. And then we go back later on. The Wolf Pack, the black and white, the red and black, and then the Latino World Order. It just became so watered down. It took the focus off those guys. And at that time, later on, there was some thinking that you just gave a guy an NWO t-shirt and he'd be over because they were over so much. Little did the people know that were doing that, it wasn't making the NWO stronger. It was making it weaker because it weakened those guys. Because some guys had been around for Vince in a different setting. They didn't fit the NWO. And then there were some guys that had been in Japan and had been with us, and we just threw them t-shirts. And it just, to me, was not understanding that what you had. These guys were the cream of the crop. They had to be protected. And because we started adding guys, and we added guys, and this is no disrespect to anybody, we added guys that shouldn't have been in there. And I think that hurt them in the long run. And I think it actually hurt the whole business in the long run.
Do you think with just Hogan, I know you said eventually you're going to want to add six in, which is absolutely perfect casting. But do you think with Hogan, Hall, and Nash, that is like the top, you know, that it's, you know, not that it's going to go downhill from there, but do you think like that's the best trio you're really going to get?
I don't think you can get anything better than, at that time, the icon of wrestling. You remember the Superman way back when with Christopher Reeves? Remember the three people from Krypton? They were the Bizarro WCW. They were the WWF that was stamped all over them. And that's what made it believable that people actually thought, I knew this was an invasion. Then when you started bringing WCW guys, jumping ship and getting on them, people were saying, well, they're working now. Even though it went for a while, I'm going to say this without any knowledge of what I'm talking about, but I'm going to say that when we added three or four more guys each time we did, it took a dip, slightly. And then what saved it was then along came Goldberg, along with Sting and Luger and the top guys. But every time we had guys jump, I think it hurt the believability of it. When I was a kid and I went to the wrestling matches, I've said this before to you, I knew it was bullshit. I had wrestled amateurs since I've been 10. I knew you couldn't beel a guy by his hair. I knew you couldn't pull a full 240-pound man down by his tights. But they presented it, the willing suspension of disbelief. And I'm saying to you that I knew it was prearranged, but I thought the Sheik was real. So it's like people back in the day thought the world championship matches were real. You know what I mean? Oh, it's all fake except the championship match. It doesn't matter. There's willing suspension of disbelief when you put it in. It's like you get wrapped up into it. And that's why I think we're probably going to get a lot of heat on this one. I watched the product today, And some of the participants do not look like professional heavyweight wrestlers. I think at this time, a company would be smart to start a middleweight class, a light heavyweight class, a cruiserweight class, because how can you have a guy that weighs 167 pounds against a guy 240 pounds and have people check the believability at the door? Do you think that's possible, John?
No.
And I think the more you do it, the less people are going to respond. I think right now we're in a very watershed moment of the wrestling business because people can't go to the matches. Are they going to get into a thing where they forget why they went to the matches? It's going to be very interesting to when this goes away and we can have shows again. They miss the product so much that they'll come out in droves, or maybe it's they don't miss it that much and they've got out of the habit of going to the shows and they're going to be in trouble. It's going to be very interesting to see. I want the business to flourish. I want the business to go on forever, and I want people to be able to make money in this business, because almost everybody that gets in this business works hard at this profession. And if you don't have people coming out and you don't get ratings, I'm rooting for them.
Yeah, I mean, oof. It is not looking too good for them right now, but hopefully it starts picking up for them, because it definitely sure ain't no, July of 96 WCW, where, it's absolutely red hot. And, the Nitro right after Bash of the Beach is basically, you're in shock as a fan. Like, can't believe Hogan is a bad guy. Why is he with Hall and Nash? What the hell is going on? That promo that he cut on everyone telling us to stick it, we could shove it as fans, and, they basically, he betrayed us. So, really the next night on Nitro, it's kind of just like super hot. I mean, it's just insane. Are you feeling the vibrations, if you will? Are you feeling that, like, wow, we are onto something? This is over like Rover.
Oh, yeah. When Hogan came down and dropped the leg, the ring fills up with trash. Mm-hmm. And standing there and they're not flinching and stuff is coming in. I knew it got over even better than I thought. I mean, it was over big time. And I think the people really wanted Hogan to turn because they were sick of listening to his say your prayers, take your vitamins, brother. And this really resurrected him. And it was very good.
Now, he's not on the next Nitro, but he'll be on the week after. So is that a purpose, like purposely kind of to let you show?
No, what happened was he either had to go back to do some voiceovers for a film, or he had to do, I'm not sure exactly what it was, but during this time, Hogan was doing a couple of B-movies, and he did one in Cincinnati at the fairgrounds, or an old amusement park. I think that was with him as a strongman. Do you remember that?
Oh, yeah, Three Ninjas.
Yeah, Three Ninjas, that's what he was. And then he was doing another one that was very similar to that, where he was out in California, where he was it was a Rambo-type movie. And I don't think that ever hit the screen. I think that was straight to DVD. So, yeah, he was wrapped up pretty. And, he had just finished, if you remember, maybe a year before that, before he came to us, the Thunder in Paradise. So he was still busy doing other things.
So really, it's just one of those things where you're like dying to see more of this NWO thing, which is great. You just show Bash the Beach, it's building, building, building. The next week, he's going to cut, a scathing promo. They're going to throw trash again. He's a wanted man. They want to kill him. Are you just loving how over? Man, this is just getting insane amount of heat on the Hulkster and the NWO.
Yeah, I mean, my philosophy is People pay to see people get beat. It's like going back to Ali. Think about this. Ali was a Olympic hero even before he beat Sonny for the belt. People were booing him. I mean, I just watched the thing on YouTube just recently where his fight against Doug Jones. It was a controversial decision, they said. He went 10 rounds and he predicted that Doug Jones would fall in 5 because the fight before he said Moore will fall in 4 and Moore did fall in 4 and he had been predicting his wins, his knockouts, and he came through with all of them. And then when he fights Doug Jones, they go 10 rounds and people are booing and say, oh, they gave him the decision. I watched the fight very carefully. And it was two of the judges called it 5-4, one for Ali, and the other one had an 8-1-1 for Ali. And I looked at it, and I would have said it was 7-3 for Ali. So he was definitely one, but the people revolted because they want to see him either knock a guy out in the round he said or see him lose. So, and then later on when Ali beat Liston, everybody wanted to see him get his head knocked off. So I think heat is what draws people to the arena. And that wasn't always my belief either. That was not always my belief. And I had a long talk with Jim Barnett, and Jim really gave me a lot of good advice about heat. Because Jim Barnett doesn't get the credit he deserves. He was right up there. I could count on one hand and have fingers left over. The three smartest guys I ever met, and Barnett would be on that hand.
Who would be the other two?
Eddie Graham and Vince Sr.
Pretty good list.
Yeah.
So as we are rolling along and, you know, the next week pops up, we'll have like the outsiders causing trouble. You know, it's like a slow burn, right? A slow build of heat. You don't want to give too much away as you're building towards Hog Wild 96. So is that kind of the thought process? Let's slowly build it, get everybody all fired up, get everybody pissed off, tease here, little tease there, you know, and basically balloon this thing up?
Yeah, my thought process was this, John. I just had the biggest turn in wrestling history. So I lit the huge fire. If I had thrown gas on the huge fire, it might have burnt itself out. Let it start to get some oxygen, let it breathe, and let it start burning on its own. Because I do believe you feel down, but all of a sudden, the next thing you know, you burnt your house and the barn and the neighborhood. You got to be very cautious when you get all that heat for people to understand why they did it and not overdo it. Because if you do it every time, if people listen and they want to be bookers, do not fall into a pattern. And it's very easy to fall into a pattern. And if I could give you some advice, if you're doing this, some people listen to running towns, have somebody you can trust in that will tell you you're full of shit and not say yes. So if you get somebody like that, that will keep you on you from painting off the easel, it will help you. Right then, I'd say I was at my best, that I knew everything I was doing was laid out for years in my mind, and it was the proper way to go.
Do you think that is the easy, not easy, but when you're on a roll as a booker, does everything come to you easier as far as where you're heading next?
John, you can make mistakes, and they turn out not to be mistakes. And all of a sudden, you'll find somebody like a Brian Pillman, who you thought, oh, this guy's a good performer, good talent, and then he's a brilliant talent, and it just makes you look smarter. Yeah, when you're on this roll, like you said, things become easy. And I think it's when you're on this roll that people see the business they're in really starting to catch on fire, and they, not saying they never didn't work at, but they give it a little extra 10%, and they're really sharp, and they want to go out and have the best match because things are good now, and the great atmosphere in the dress room, and everybody's, hey, hell of a match when they came back, rather than when the business is flat and you're out there busting your ass and things aren't going good. When you come back, guys don't say good match. They, oh, did you see it? Yeah. Great match. Who did I work with? Oh, I don't know. I think it was the atmosphere too. And there was a little bit of reality of it. They came down and they were kicking ass. And these guys before this, I always equate things to baseball. They always used to say that the Red Sox were a glorified country club baseball team, that when they went out, there was 25 cabs. Everybody took their own cab. There was no camaraderie-ship. When this was going on, everybody was pushing for everybody else and it upped their game.
It really was kind of hitting on all cylinders. You're right. There's a certain, I guess, thing of kind of not overdoing it, like you said, not kind of giving everything away, doing that slow burn. Is that kind of going through your mind? Like, okay, we have a certain amount of weeks. Let's do this. Like, not have Hogan make necessarily, you know, obviously he couldn't, but not necessarily have him come out right away and kind of promo. Let's, you know, show the footage again. And then the next week, the crowd will be incensed even more. Is the slow burn, is that the most effective kind of booking technique?
I don't even know if they use this term anymore, hot-shotting, where you just throw so much stuff at them. They'll come for a while, but you burnt it out. And when you do something that was this monumental, you got to be careful. It's like having a machine gun. You shoot one bullet at a time. You got to be careful not keep your finger on that trigger where you're shooting 27 rounds at a time. You got to be careful that they understand what you're doing too. It sinks in. And not having Hogan on there was good because we got a great chance to replay that and for it to sink in. And people at SAR said, yeah, watch this. This is what I was telling you about. They pick up their phone. They call their friends. Hey, they're going to show where Hulk Hogan turned bad guy. Watch it. So, yeah, you're absolutely right, John. Good call.
It was on fire at this point, like you said, it's slow burn. But as we get into July 29th, 1996 Nitro, this is going to be possibly one of the most memorable Nitros ever. It's just insane the amount of kind of reaction, not only from the fans at home, the fans in attendance, but from even the police and the fire departments and the ambulances and local authorities and everything. So that Nitro, and I know you're telling me a little bit off air, What did you mean that was the first time you gave the NWO a script? Because I'm just curious. They never really had a script per se of what was going on. And this night, what was different?
Every time we did something, it was always, and I never believe in scripts. But this time when I came up with the idea, I scripted it out because it was one of those things I actually dreamed about it. And I got up and I wrote it down and I had Janie Ingalls type it out and I gave a script to everybody that was involved. And it was the perfect thing because here is the Dungeon wrestling the Horsemen and Jimmy Hart comes out and runs down and tells us the NWO is here. We stop working and join forces and run to the back. And they're beating the shit out of us. They take Ray and they spike Ray into the trailer. The camera comes back and they're watching this people do this. And before, when I gave the guys the bats, the great story I always tell and they tell it too, I'm shaking my head. Yes, I'm saying whatever you do, do not use the bats. This is not going to be the right thing to do on TBS. They'll be really pissed at us. Do not use the bats. I'm shaking my head. Yes, use the bats. And they used it. And then Randy jumped on the limo, was hanging on the window, and the limo pulled off. He didn't know if Randy fell off. They ran him over. And what happened was there were people watching TV in Orlando that were watching Nitro, called the police. The police came. The paramedics came. We had ambulances. We had the fire truck. Disney thought it was a riot, and they actually put it on TV that night on the local channel that there was a riot at Disney, and it didn't get over with Disney. I don't know if you know this, John. No one's ever been born or died on Disney property. Are you aware of that? If you die, they go past the Disney limits and pronounce you dead. If you're born, you're not born until you get past the limits of Disney. There's a great book by Carl Heising. He did that movie Striptease with Demi Moore. He does a series about the Florida Keys that's very hysterical. But the only book that he wrote that wasn't a humorous book was The Mouse That Roared. And if you ever want to get it, read the book. It tells you how insane the Disney people are about control. It's almost like a cult. It's pretty wild. But anyway, they didn't appreciate getting called that there was a riot.
Yeah, I would imagine not. Save Disney, all of a sudden, you know, you got the police, like you said, the paramedics, the ambulance, the fire. Not really knowing your Disney MGM Studios at this point, it's like, this is, you know, something is off here. But it just goes to show you the realism thing of the NWO and how over it was and how so many people thought it was legit, right?
Right. Everybody bought into it. And then you look back and you say, boy, this is one of those things where people really bought into it and didn't think it was such a work. Because realistically, if that had happened, wouldn't a TBS said we got technical difficulties? They would have shown that. And that's how intense the NWO was. And wouldn't we hear about them being arrested and being in an Orlando jail? The reason why I think it was so good, it will never be duplicated again. The internet. Could you imagine doing that today and then Scott Hall get on the internet and say, oh, that thing worked perfectly. Thank you, Ray, for taking that bump. That was great.
It would be ridiculous. It would kill it, obviously. Yep.
I read on the Twitter about thank you for my match, and he hugged him just after his first main event match and hugged him, and the guy got some real serious heat on him, and oh, he was great, and I told him thank you very much. Well, if they did that, it wouldn't have worked. And I know we're in a social media era, and we live and die with numbers. But if they had done that, they would have the ratings that they have today.
Think about when Nash lawn darts Mysterio, and you're mentioning you know how great that was. The trailer, Ray jumps, and Nash reacts and tosses him literally like a lawn dart. I mean, that was all planned with the Mysterio and Nash, or no?
That was in the script, yeah. What I saw was, you got to remember, Kevin was huge. In my day, I was pretty strong, and I would work out with Kevin. He was long-limbed. And he was pulling 700 pounds when we were doing back. What he would do is said he would pump up to twice the size. So Kevin was huge. And then the thing about Rage, who we were pushing very hard, Ray brought a lot, and Ray, Conan, Juventud brought a lot of new young fans to wrestling because Ray looked like he just came out of a little eggshell. You know, he looked like a little chick, but he could run and dive and wrestle. And when he dove on Kevin, and Kevin caught him like it was a little bird and turned around and mashed that bird's head, it got Kevin a lot of heat. And the size difference, it was again portraying how big Kevin was. And if you remember what that angle was, looking up at Kevin, here's what happened too, was because I did that, the camera work, they knew exactly where they were going. And Keith Mitchell, who is now, I believe, the head of production in AEW, was brilliant. But sometimes he got people that weren't so brilliant on the cameras that were interns and stuff. But everybody knew where their spot was that night, and that's why it worked. I don't think scripting out everything would be the right way to go, but that was so important. I did it more for the camera than the guys. Because I think that even if I didn't say it, Ray would have jumped on Kevin because they were friends and Kevin would have figured out what to do with them. One thing about Kevin and Scott, they weren't afraid and didn't know did not know how not to get heat. They knew how to get heat.
As far as the scripting of stuff, how come you would just script there and didn't really want to script anything else with them? Is that kind of kill a little bit of the organicness of it?
Yes, it does. Terry Funk told me a story that he went to a company the last time he went, and they wrote him a script to do an interview. And he said, gave him the script back, and he said, I know how to do Terry Funk. I've been doing it for 50 years. All of a sudden, there's no great talkers in our business. How did that happen? There's nobody that talks people into the building anymore. How did that happen? All those great talkers. You think the Hard Times interview that somebody scripted Dusty? You think somebody scripted Billy Graham? You think somebody scripted King Curtis Iaquea? Somebody scripted Hogan? Somebody scripted The Rock? Maybe The Rock, but I doubt it. I mean, the talkers are themselves. They're just an extension of their real-life personalities, just magnified.
There's no way those guys are being scripted.
No. And the script I did that night, I think, was so important because it had never been done before. We never had people breaking kayfabe in a wrestling match that I know of. I did it because I didn't want them to miss a camera shot. And I didn't want to go in and say, this is the shot, this is the shot, this is the shot. I wanted to make sure they knew exactly what was happening.
And was it all done live?
Yep, it was all live. All live.
So were you worried at all that maybe it might not work? Because if it, you know, let's just say it didn't work. I mean, it might not look great. I mean, it turned out unbelievable. But were you ever nervous it may not work out the way you wanted it to?
No, because we were on a roll and I had the 1927 Yankees, Murderers Row. Mm-hmm. I had the best talent ever assembled in the history of the wrestling business, as you were well aware. I mean, how could I lose? But the only thing that I was afraid of was the production end, that I didn't know some of the cameramen. I knew most of the people in production, but that night the week before there happened to be a few interns running cameras, and I thought, oh, and they had missed not a crucial shot, but a couple of shots, which was no big deal, but I said, oh, I don't want them to miss this one, and that's why I did it. And hey, if Kevin didn't throw Ray against the trailer, he would have open a manhole cover and drop Ray in. They knew how to get it.
Now, the one thing that I think is possibly, besides the lawn dart, one of the most memorable things of that Nitro. So the NWO makes the attack. Everybody's running. Arn is injured. And they actually have to take off Ray's mask, which made it so much more believable, too. Taking off Ray's mask, was that scripted as well? Because that was made it seem so real, like, wow, they're actually taking off his mask. They must really be injured.
Right. It was. It was scripted. I wanted to make it as real as I possibly could. And with the paramedics, if they're going to look at a guy's head, leave a mask on?
Right. Good point. Yep.
I think all these little things made it so real. It worked. And again, I had the best talent in the world.
The second most memorable thing to me is the Macho Man, Randy Savage. He makes everything seem like the guys always make it seem real. But to me, his intensity, the way he reacts, everything is a shoot. Like, it's like, watch Savage. Like that. Remember, we were talking about a few weeks ago with Pillman, when Pillman, maybe he thought Pillman legit was sneaking in or not. He made it seem real. You know, Hogan's hitting him with, like, you know, weak shots. Savage is literally ripping his shirt, trying to kill the guy. So when the NWO goes for the attack, Savage jumps in the top of the limo and tries to get in as the limo is driving away. So you're like, holy shit, this must be real. Was that scripted at all? Was that Macho Man? Because that was insane.
That was his. He came up and said, I think I'll jump on the limo when it goes. I said, well, whatever you want, Randy. I mean, see, they made it easy. they were so in tune to the character. But that was Randy. Randy would do that. Randy was crazy, and a good crazy. He would have done that if it was a shoot. And Randy took everything as a shoot. He wasn't going to let anybody get over him, scratched and clawed to become a top guy. And he knew that this was going good, and he knew that he was smart, that all this thing happened, John, and you remember the dot, and you remember Randy. And me too.
Were you nervous at all? Like, you know, the limo is going to be driving away, and this guy is stuck with his legs in the middle, you know, up in the air. And, yeah, he, a possibility, you know, he may get injured.
Yeah, I thought, hey, he's going to take a – but knowing Randy, he'd take a bump and roll and like a stuntman and get up and dust himself off. I enjoyed Randy Savage's company. I spent a lot of time with Randy outside of the business, and I really enjoyed hanging with Randy.
I just, like, you know, as a fan, you're like, my God, you know, this is real. And my God, Macho Man is definitely nuts to do that. Is that one of those things that just adds to it, too? I mean, it just makes it seem that much more real that he would do something like that?
It was every layer added believability. Every layer. Guys getting slammed. Rick kicking guys, chop them, and all of a sudden Jimmy Hart runs down. They're attacking us. They're attacking us. So we join hands and run to the back to save them. We get beat up. Kevin takes Lil Ray and spikes them. They jump in the car to take off after they dropped everybody. People are screaming. There comes Randy like a banshee. Jumps on the car, clinging on the window. They take off at 90 miles an hour. Dirt being thrown up, tires squealing. It was brilliant.
So the interesting thing here is just another layer to throw in there is not only the NWO Hogan Hall Nash attack. They leave everybody laying. Ray gets lawn darted. Anderson is injured. You know, all these guys are laid out. Savage is nuts, jumps in top of the limo, tries to, you know, get out and be basically, you know, beat up the NWO. But the thing is, there's a mystery fourth man, and that keeps getting kind of subtly thrown out there that there was four of them. There was four of them. Are you sure there was four of them? How important is it to keep kind of teasing that there's more members and that there is this mystery fourth member out there?
I think it was very important at the time because this was Kevin and Scott's choice. This was their idea, along with somebody else, who I won't reveal yet. And it worked out perfectly.
This tease of a fourth man, actually, it's not going to be revealed right away because you're still going to be building up for Hog Wild. There's still going to be a few nitros kind of in between. So as we're kind of building up for Hogwild, what's your thoughts? Like, you're just going to kind of tease it and throw it out there as a fourth guy. You don't want to reveal it just yet. It's almost, like you said, a slow burn. You don't want to just keep chugging guys out there and making this group into a super group as of yet. Just keep them three.
Right. They don't need anybody else except the threesome right now. They've decided on the fourth one themselves. So, okay, let's not rush it. Let's get as much mileage out of it as we can.
So in the meantime, there's going to be the paid announcements by the NWO. We've spoken to Neil Pruitt about it. We've talked to Bischoff about it. Whose idea is this?
Neil Pruitt never got the recognition he deserves. Very, very smart guy. He helped Kevin and Scott tremendously. He came up with this idea, and this thing got over like gangbusters. It was brilliant. And I'm going to make a little comment on it right now, okay? Nash Hall could have killed Hulk. What you see is not what was taped. Hulk was very tentative with these guys. They had to take a step backwards. And you know the thing they do with their fingers when they point one of the other one out, you know, over the head? They had to give him that in reality to come out of his shell. If you watch the promos that I saw, this was a brilliant, brilliant editing by Neil Pruitt. Hulk, he hadn't been a heel for a long, long time. Nobody had seen heels like these guys. And he was over his head. He really was, because anybody would be. They just turn a guy heel and you expect him to run with these guys. It's very difficult, but these guys step back and they made Hollywood Hulk Hogan, that's for sure. And they were very, very smart to do it. A lot of guys wouldn't have done it. They would have said, oh, I'm going to get mine. But these guys knew in the long run, and they saw what Hulk turning, what it meant for them. They were on a gravy train.
As far as him being Hollywood Hogan, I want to get back to those videos just a second, but as far as him being Hollywood Hogan and kind of making it not Hulk, obviously it's part of his character, but was there any sort of issues with like Marvel at this point with the Incredible Hulk, of him calling himself Hulk? Was that anything to do with wanting to kind of change his name at all or no?
No, the Marvel thing had been settled by Vince years prior. They had paid some ungodly amount of money. And I don't know the in and outs of it. If anybody tells you they do, they're liars. I'm sure that Marvel comic books got a percentage of everything somewhere down the line, or they got a huge payoff, one of the two. But no, it was Hulk wanted the Hollywood Hulk Hogan to be the Hill persona.
If you just think about it, I mean, just a perfect name, because he's going Hollywood. He's a sellout. He's a turncoat. Perfect name, right? Hollywood Hulk Hogan. Even the way you would say it, Hollywood.
And then getting the rights to Jimi Hendrix music, right? Voodoo Child.
Oh, man, that just added to it big time. One of the greatest songs of all time. I'll say that. How much did it cost? Because everyone always says a number.
Whatever the number was, it was well worth it.
I mean, believe Bischoff said it was in the neighborhood of $100,000.
I see that easily, yeah.
But you guys kind of had the rights to it, right? If somebody else wanted to play it, they would kind of have to go through you because you guys had the preliminary rights to it. Is that how that goes?
I think so. I'm pretty sure you're right on the money.
And I think that if you think about that song, it just added to the heel persona of Hogan. It just made it that much better because, you know, he had the awesome NWO theme, as Scott Hall would call it, the porno theme, which was, you know, an epic, awesome song. But Voodoo Child, I mean, whew, just added to Hogan, him running around in a circle when he was the champion with it. That song going out, him saying, chop it down with the edge of my hand, going to stand up next to the mountain, going to chop it down. And then him doing that, just everything just kind of aligned perfectly with the character and who Hogan was at that time.
Everything did align up perfectly.
Now, the NWO, for sure, changed the culture, did so many cool things. But just want to mention that video again, or those series of videos. Neil Pruitt, obviously, was a big part of that. The original idea, like to do promos and stuff, is it one of those things where it's like, okay, we don't necessarily want them at the show, but we want to have them have a spot on the show to keep the heel heat going. So is that kind of the thought process? Let's do promos with them and video packages and then slowly have them come out on the show?
Yeah, and we wanted to insert them in that they were buying time. I didn't have Mean Gene interview them, so how can we get them on? Because their promo was as good as their work rate, which was terrific. So how do you do that? But Neil Pruitt did it, came up with real hip ideas, especially for the time. And those interviews were great. I can remember Hogan kicking it looked like a beach ball, but it was the Globe. You remember that? Neil came up with some brilliant ideas, and those guys performed remarkably well.
We're really kind of leading into Hogwild and Sturgis, and I think that'll be an episode all to itself because, I mean, there was so much kind of stuff going on, and, I mean, that's a big point. That'll definitely be a topic that we will cover because that is such a huge pay-per-view as far as moving the storyline forward of Hogan capturing the title. I think that in and of itself is so important that not only is the NWO taking over, but now Hogan is the champion, and I think that adds to it as well, right? I mean, that's kind of the thought.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You're right on, John.
With kind of leading into that show, and I won't go too much into it as we kind of head towards the finish here, but the Giant is the champion. He's the heel. Hogan in the NWO is the heel. Is there any thought of like, all right, maybe we need to make the Giant a face and do anything with him kind of leading up? Or is it just thinking that the NWO is such heels, the Giant's automatically going to be a baby face?
If you turn the Giant baby face, you're telling the people that that's a work. Giant is going to be a babyface because he's against the NWO. Or was he really a babyface because some of the people liked the NWO? I didn't care as long as people tuned in and people bought tickets to come. The boys become the hottest heels and the hottest babyfaces at the same time.
Yeah, for sure. And the thing about them is they're so cool. Me and all my friends and like the whole football team, we're at this point and even, you know, rival schools too, and everyone in the school. But I just vividly remember this. We were obsessed with the NWO. Everyone had their NWO t-shirts. You know, they were all getting into the NWO. We would literally say, okay, you know, we do a little thing of who gets to play what member of the NWO. Me and my buddy would fight over who's Hall. So, you know, he won the, you know, the rock, paper, scissors. So I'm Nash. He's Hall. I mean, you just, even as a kid, you're like, these are the coolest guys. I not only want to be these guys, I want to copy these guys. We're, you know, we're saying their catchphrases. We're playing Voodoo Child. We're playing the NWO theme. I mean, it literally, not only for us, but we noticed older people and older kids and our parents were getting into wrestling again. You know, they haven't been in because of Hogan turning heel. Right? I mean, this was, you're right, changing culture. It was the coolest thing, and it was quote unquote hip to the mainstream culture.
Right. That's what it was. It became really hip to be a wrestling fan again.
Now, the actual NWO, the letters and the design, who was creating that as far as the t-shirt designs and the way it's written?
I heard that was Craig Leathers. Then there was a girl that worked in production, Annette Yother. I heard she did it too. I heard they were in a mall in Disney when we were down there, and they saw a book or a license plate that had that NWO on it, and they came up with that.
Man, iconic, awesome. Yeah. And it's one of those things where people still wear it today. I mean, I've seen the Kardashians wear it and all these other celebrities, Drake, Kanye, and the merchandise is still selling.
Yep, that's amazing. So those guys can sit at home at the beach and money comes in from their t-shirts after 20 years.
It's an insane, if you think about that logo, it is so simplistic, but it is so epic, right? I mean, is that the beauty of it?
Beauty is in the eye of the beholder. It's like art. I have some people in my family that are artists, so I don't know much about art, but I got a little bit from osmosis from being around them. But Kevin knows about it, and we talked about that logo a couple of times, how brilliant it was. It was easy on the head to have it. It was great. Whoever came up with it, they got an iconic logo forever.
Yeah, and I actually, you know, in a private conversation with Nash, I mentioned something with the logo, and he said the beauty of it was it's not a quote-unquote wrestling shirt, and that people didn't necessarily think it was a wrestling shirt per se. I mean, it's awesome that everyone associates it with wrestling. They know it's NWO, but it doesn't look like the guy's face. You know what I mean? Like, it's not Hogan's face on the shirt, brother.
And how many people would come up with that vision that he saw that? Not many people. I never thought of it that way, but it's not a wrestling t-shirt. It's a t-shirt that could be talking about the Illuminati, could be talking about a rap band, could be talking about anything. It's very cool.
And obviously, you know, when there was live shows going on, you would still see NWO shirts in the crowd. It's crazy how popular the NWO is, was, and forever will be. But the logo is just awesome and totally unforgettable. So as we kind of move through, we will definitely discuss more of the NWO because, to me, the greatest booking of all time, the greatest group of all time, the greatest faction of all time, just so well done. Everything was done so excellently. I just absolutely loved it. But let's get into some plugs. You can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Two Man Power Trip. The website is TMPEmpire.com. TMPTEmpire.com. That is TMPTEmpire.com. For Kevin, you could follow him on Instagram at Taskmaster Talks. Pro Wrestling Tees. Yes, ProWrestlingTees.com. Check out Kevin Sullivan's store. Got a couple really great shirts on there. And speaking of great shirts, I want to mention this as well. Double Hell T-shirts. You have a T-shirt store on there with even more great T-shirts. So check out Double Hell T-shirts. Now, Kev, do you have some personal appearances going on? I know that this is a crazy world.
Supposed to be coming up to New York on the 18th, 19th, and 20th for some virtual signings. So I'm looking forward to that. So I'm looking forward to maybe running into you, John, somewhere, right?
Yes, I was hoping you'd say that. Yes, for sure.
Okay, cool. Thank you, John. It was great reliving the NWO.
All right. Now, this week, obviously, was a great trip down memory lane talking about the NWO. Thank you for joining us, folks. You can join us here each and every week on the Creative Control Network. This has been Taskmaster Talks with Kevin Sullivan. See you next week, folks.
Stick. Wait a minute. We go to the back. Arn Anderson down. There they are. They got baseball bats. The coward jerk. That's Marcus Bagwell.
Hey, wait a minute.
All the everybody's left the ring here, and there's Rey Mysterio.
Hey, he dove off. What?
That's Rey Mysterio. There's the Cruiserweight Champion, Rey Mysterio. Oh, no. Hey! Head first into the trailer in the back.
He threw him like he was a dart.
Arn Anderson, the first man we saw down. All six wrestlers have left the ring. This match is going to be a double countout.
What match?
The Macho Man.
He's on the...
The Macho Man is on the limousine.
Trying to get the sunroom.
Oh, my God. I don't know if we can... The Macho Man is grabbing through the limousine.
I told you he's nuts.